Welcome back to the Dialogue Studio. This podcast series is hosted by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. In it, we explore the transformational practice of dialogue and why it is important, especially in this current moment. I'm your host, Lillian E. In these episodes, you will hear from individuals from all walks of life sharing what dialogue means to them and how they are practicing it in their daily lives. We will also introduce our founder, Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue and the various approaches and strategies we practice here at the center. Hello, everyone. Happy May. I hope you are enjoying spring and seeing the blooming flowers and leaves. I also hope you enjoyed the kickoff of our new What Do We Mean By series last month. For today's episode, I will be speaking with Professor Alexander Harong from Soka University of America, also known as SUA, located in Aliso Viejo in Southern California. Professor Harong is a distinguished adjunct professor at SUA and senior research fellow at SUA's Soka Institute for Global Solutions. We are also excited to share that Professor Harong will be supporting the Ikeda Center as our new senior peace researcher. He brings more than two decades of leadership experience from the international peace movement, as well as research and teaching experience from peace academia. During our conversation, I asked Professor Harong about how he got involved in the peace field, how he first encountered Daisaku Ikeda's work, what does peace look like at this time, and what he is looking forward to in his new role at the center. Alexander, I want to really thank you for joining us in the Dialogue Studio today. We've had the great fortune at the center to get to know you a little bit over the last couple months, and I'm excited for our listeners to get to know you as well. You have a really fascinating story that I've heard bits and pieces of in interviews and in our conversations, you know, internally, but also with our other scholar friends. But I'm really curious, you know, to hear directly from you about your story and how did you get involved in the peace field?
Thank you so much for having me, Lillian. It's such a wonderful experience getting to be with you. That's every time we meet, we met a few times already. And I've been really looking forward to meeting you in this space as well, in a podcast. So, about my story, how do you make that short and sweet? Well, firstly, I know where it began. I come from this land up north, which is called Norway. I grew up on a tiny little island, far away from civilization, like 300 inhabitants, and I would say maybe 800 guns. So that's a condition that is not very often connected to peace researchers. But, you know, that was my environment. We were growing up with fishermen and a couple of farmers, and the wide open seas. That was my environment. And pretty much the only academic around on this island was my father. He was into technology. And his work was on automation and electronics at a scientific university in Norway. And he and his wife, my mother, came up with this Rousseauian idea, back to the nature, just like the old Frenchman used to say. So what about trying to reconnect with nature, taking their family out of this little place far away from everything and see what happens? And that was an interesting experience. It was a tiny little community with very high social control. And it sort of forced you to get out there, you know, out in touch with the real forces of nature. And I would say I'm very, very connected to nature in that sense. Both as a fisherman, as, you know, a tree planter and a hunter, and, you know, everything is nature is wonderful. So that's a little bit about, you know, where it all started.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about nature. I hadn't heard this part of your story. And I think when I think about Ikeda's philosophy, you know, he talks a lot about how our loss of connection with nature
contributes,
you know, greatly to the war and violence we see in our world right now.
Absolutely.
So it's really encouraging to hear that before you even really knew it,
oh, yeah,
your
yeah.
peace work had begun as a young child.
I was kind of born into peace work.
Right.
So I was very fortunate in that sense that I came, you know, I'm born into a family of peace activists, many generations on both sides. And my grandfather was the founder of No to Nuclear Weapons in Norway, the mass movement against nuclear weapons. So this, you know, the peace movement came almost with a mother's milk for me. So that was kind of easy. And the finding the love for nature, combining that with peace philosophy, that was also intuitive, even as a child. So I didn't really have to work too much to see these connections, you know, what Ikeda calls, you know, the creative coexistence with nature. I mean, to me, that was sort of environmental. It came out naturally. But I knew from a very early age that it was peace work that I wanted to do. And, you know, if cutting my story short, I mean, that's pretty much what I have been up to. Peace work. Everything I've done. And my entire professional career has been as a peace worker. Now, of course, I've been working for peace in many different arenas on many different topics, everything from culture for peace to peace education, academia, where I'm now. And I've also been a peace researcher for a long time. But I've also been a leader of a peace movement. Firstly, the one in Norway. And I'm still connected to that peace movement. And also internationally, I was the Norwegian representative to the International Peace Bureau, which is the umbrella for the international peace movement, for 15 years. And I was re-elected the leader of the Norwegian peace movement for 19 times. So, you know, it's been pretty much my entire life. I mean, my first national position of trust in the peace movement was at age 14, when I became youth leader for No to Nuclear Weapons. And now at age 47, I'm still in the same organization. And I'm actually head of politics in the same organization. So,
wow.
So there's a certain consistency here, you know?
Yeah, that's, again, very encouraging to hear. And I have a follow-up question for you, Alexander. We'll touch upon this a little bit later in terms of young people and their engagement with peace. But just hearing your story, I was curious. You know, I think as a young person, many youth that I speak to today obviously care deeply about peace. And yet I think when they see the problems in the world today, they feel this tremendous feeling of despair and powerlessness.
Yeah.
Of course, a sense of injustice, but, you know, not knowing how to take action. So it really struck me that as a young person, of course, you were born in a family of peace builders and, you know, immersed in that field, but it seemed like you like jumped in right away. And, I was wondering if as a young person, if you had any of those sort of struggles in thinking about the world and how did you challenge them as a young person, you know, and not be paralyzed?
No, I didn't have any challenges like that at all. And that's partly due to the fact that I grew up in the 90s and, you know, the time after the Cold War, you know, in 89, the Berlin Wall falls. And there's a wide, positive, optimistic view of the world. So, you know, I came at the right time that in that sense, you know, I didn't have to go through all that despair because, you know, these were the, this was the decade, the 90s was the decade where people were talking about the peace dividend. What are we going to do now that we spent all this money on military expenditure because of the Cold War and the Soviet bloc and the capitalist versus the communist? And the existential threat of a third world war. And now suddenly the field was open and suddenly people were starting to think, okay, now peace comes naturally, doesn't it? You know, Samuel Huntington, remember him? You know, with the Clash of Civilization. I mean, liberalism has won. That was sort of the mantra, wasn't it?
Right.
So, you know, there isn't that much more to fight for. And there was few voices out there who warned against it. Ikeda was one of them. He was one of the really strong voices. Already in the late 80s, he was warning us that, well, the time that is coming is not going to be that easy. And he was arguing against Samuel Huntington. He was seeing what was going to happen almost in a prophetic manner long before it happened. And of course, as we saw the 90s develop, there was a lot of things. This is the decade when you had the information technology revolution. Suddenly people came on internet and, you know, there was a lot of new connectiveness. But just as Ikeda also warned in the same period of time, this new connectedness, also what he often describes as virtual reality, that also disconnects us. And thinking about the young people growing up today and the challenges they face when they are to engage in peace work and peace activism, this dark backdrop that you that you describe, that is also related to this lack of connectedness that Ikeda is describing when the internet comes along. And of course, if you think about it, if you're born into a world with social media and smartphones and you're always connected in that sense, well, we should take those warnings that Ikeda voiced already in the late 90s. We should take them very seriously because it really challenges our human connectedness. Now, this is the humanist perspective that I've always had, even before I learned about Ikeda. There was one thing I was certain about, and that was that I'm 100% a humanist. And by a humanist, I mean an inclusive humanist, not only humanist in a secular sense, but also in a spiritual as well as material sense. So if there's one thing that I really trust in my life, and this goes back to maybe age six, it is humanism. I really trust that worldview, the humanist worldview. What I mean by that is, first of all, the positive view of what the human being is. That, you know, humans are of the positive. We are net positive. Okay, we do stupid stuff. But, you know, we're more good than we are bad. And, you know, in terms of nature, for instance, just to give you an example, I always consider myself an environmentalist. Being very close to nature and being part of nature has always been very important to me. When I started reading Ikeda, age 12, when I first came across him, this was one of the elements that I couldn't really connect to Buddhism, because back then I didn't know what really anything about what Buddhism is. I mean, I grew up in a place where there was no Buddhists at all. And I just, you know, the only reason I came across Ikeda was because we had something called the Bulletin of the International Peace Bureau, which I mentioned, the umbrella organization for the peace movement in the world. And they always would come with different voices from the peace movement all over the world, from Africa, from Latin America, from Asia. And suddenly one day there was this guy called Ikeda that was on the front page of the IPB bulletin, this Buddhist guy from Japan. And that was exciting, you know, 12-year-old. I mean, wow, Japan, wow, what is that like? And he's a Buddhist. A Buddhist, what is that? That's kind of, you know, we didn't have those people around. So it was really, really interesting to see an Eastern perspective on what we in the Western peace movement, where I was involved from a very early age, dealing with the exact same questions, the questions of nonviolence. You know, how can we create a culture of peace, a culture where we don't need to use violence, where we don't use threats, where we don't use somatic violence, where we can fight poverty and we can take care and create a sustainable environment, which is also socially sustainable, and socially sustainable in this context, meaning peaceful, right? So seeing an Eastern perspective on what all the issues that we already had at hand from a Western perspective, that was extremely exciting and very, very, very felt like an adventure. So by the age 16, about 16, I started to study Buddhism. And then, of course, then I started to get the bigger picture that, you know, it wasn't only the policy recommendations that was interesting from Ikeda. It was actually the Buddhist cosmology and the way of thinking. And that's led me to travel a lot to all the Buddhist countries. I came to the conclusion very early that there must be something about these Buddhist cultures because they tend to be less war prone than others. So let's have a look. Let's have a visit. So I traveled a lot in my late teens and early 20s to Buddhist countries and Buddhist cultures and really got to learn a lot about peace. I already knew I would be a peace researcher. My first mentor in life was Johann Galtung, who recently passed in last month. And I was sitting on his lap as a child. I was with him since the beginning. So I was deeply into peace academia even before I became a teenager. So, you know, when I got into university, I already knew where I was going to end up. I knew it was going to be peace research. But on that path and in those years, it's, you know, I got more and more influenced by the Eastern perspectives. And not only the Buddhist perspective, but, you know, the Jainist perspective, Gandhi. Gandhi became a big hero very, very early in my life. And I also served in the Gandhi Brigade, and I did a lot of different things in India. And but, you know, in my early 20s, I sort of settled on the Buddhist worldview. And I found that 100% compatible with that humanist worldview that I grew up with. In my line of thinking, humanism, as defined by the first thing I mentioned, you know, a positive view of what it is being human and what it is being a humanity. That's the first thing. And the second thing I would say is that there's a, in a humanist worldview, there's a moral commitment to the human flourishing, you know, the flourishing of all human beings. And with that, it is also a commitment to reduce human suffering. Now, these two goes together. And, of course, in a Buddhist cosmology, or from a good Buddhist perspective, these things are, you know, really key. And they are intuitive to all Buddhists I ever talked to, I think. But they also fit in very well in a humanist worldview, that, you know, the humanist worldview as such.
Thank you, Alexander. I have so many different trains of thought that I want to explore with you. But I think the first one that I'll respond to is, thank you for sharing when you first encountered Daisaku Ikeda as a 12-year-old. And also the image of you sitting in Johann Galtung's lap is also very wonderful as well. And, you know, you talked about, and thank you also for sharing your perspective on being a humanist. And I think, you know, I was thinking back to the first time I encountered Ikeda in my life as a Buddhist and how struck I was by his sort of unconditional belief in the goodness of human beings, as you shared. Yes, and I think up until that point in my life, I had really thought that humans are inherently bad.
isn't that exactly, you know, the times we're living in? And isn't, you know, the times we grew up in? You're a bit younger than me, but still, you know, we grew up in a time when not only mainstream media, but, you know, just about anyone you had around you, it could be school system, everyone was pointing to you as a human. Exactly. Saying that, you know, you are a net negative.
Absolutely. And, you know,
and this is really, really, really key to this creative coexistence that I mentioned that is so important in Ikeda's thinking, because it's human centered. It doesn't mean that humans are the only thing. No. But we are to understand what is around us as interconnected with us. And we have to see this from the human experience, from what it is being human. Now, a human-centered ecology doesn't think about humans as cancers to the earth. A human-centered ecology thinks about humans as a part of the entire ecology's life support systems. And we have to be sustainable as part of a life support system. Now, to me, that's a much more interesting and much more positive, much more hopeful, and much more joyful road to travel when it comes to taking care of the environment. And environmentalism is just one part of it. I mean, you can go to other elements as well. If you look at, for instance, how Ikeda approaches poverty, how we need to fight poverty and eradicate extreme poverty, the way that Ikeda approaches this is very human-centered. It's, again, you see that it is all the problems we face. This is something I really think we can learn from Ikeda, that he always starts with addressing what is it being human? How deeply can you identify those barriers you face as part of the human experience? Now, if you come at it from this approach, then it's a lot easier to keep your spirits up. And that's exactly when you need people like Ikeda, who identify hope and produce hope, creates hope. Like he says, hope is a decision, right? I mean, that's about agency. This is about placing agency at us as individuals. You know, we can actually do something. We can actually create something. Okay, it's demanding. It's demanding a lot of us. I mean, we need self-mastery. We need to be responsible. And there's a lot of things that are demanding to us, but that's part of the human experience. And we don't learn without resistance. We never learn. You never make real progress if you don't have any form of barriers. Mm. If it's just smooth sailing, then it's meaningless. That's the big thing. Yeah, but it really is. Think about it. If you think about what is meaning, I mean, is it possible for you to think of any person you ever met that have a meaningful life without any form of responsibility? Is that possible? Because I met quite a few thousand people, but I never met one of those. I don't think they exist.
Neither. Yeah.
You know, you need to have certain responsibility. You need to have a certain self-mastery to achieve any sort, to experience any sort of meaning. And here's a key thing that I've learned from Ikeda that I always tell my students in one shape or form, that, you know, if I'm going to give you a life advice, carry as much responsibility as you can. Muster as much responsibility as you can, because you probably won't regret it. You need resistance. You need to challenge yourself, and you need to take responsibility of your own being, your own relationship to yourself, to the fellow human beings, to the nature around you, to the entire ecology. There's a key message here, which I think that we very often lose sight of in these days. When you think about freedom as something limitless, that it's just about my needs. So, you know, if I feel like doing something and I get to do it, that's freedom, isn't it? Well, it's not that easy. That is not that easy. There is not really any freedom to talk about without any sort of restrictions, limitations. Everything is a bit more complicated than that. If your concept of living a good life is just living a life without resistance and free flow, well, then you won't really be living, will you? It will be a pretty poor living condition. You will be victim of your own emotions and just following them. And that's not a good life to live.
Thank you for sharing all of that, Alexander. Maybe going back to, you were describing the state of our world right now. I think one of the questions that we've been thinking a lot about here at the center is the times that we live in right now. And I think in these times of so much war and conflict, what does peace look like? I think is a question that is hard to think about now. Peace almost feels impossible, or maybe just too idealistic to think about. But I was wondering if you can share, you know, based on your experience and also learning so much from Ikeda, how would he define peace and building cultures of peace? Like, what would that look like?
Thank you for a very, very, very interesting and extremely big question, isn't it? It's a very big one. But first of all, I mean, you're right about in your assumption. We're definitely living in times of war. There's absolutely no doubt about it. One thing is that we have the big conflicts ongoing, the huge wars. I'm talking about Ukraine since 22, especially since the invasion of Russia. And the Middle East, of course, but we have many other conflicts ongoing that we very often forget about. I'm thinking about the Sahel Belt in Africa, talking about Ethiopia, Darfur. There's a lot of things going on right now. And if you just look at the International Crisis Group that gives an overview every month on how different conflicts are becoming better or worse, if you look at the last overview from April, you'll see that 10 of the most violent conflicts in the world are actually deteriorating as we speak. So there's no doubt that we're going in the wrong direction. It doesn't matter if you talk about Ethiopia, Bangladesh, Colombia, even Georgia, Myanmar. There's very many of them that we tend to forget about. And the big picture is dark. Now, what does peace look like on that dark backdrop? Well, I think it can be seen as something quite simple. At least this is a thing that I very often use in my life when I'm in conflicts and also when I'm negotiating in bigger conflicts. What does a future where the parties to a conflict share that future, what does that future look like?
That's a key question. If you can envision a future with today's enemies together, in togetherness, so that they don't disconnect, they don't isolate, and they don't continue their path as enemies, but they have a shared vision, a future that they would both like to see happen, then we're talking about peace. And the reason why I like to pose that question, what does a common future look like? If I'm in a conflict with a friend or with my partner, or if I'm thinking about a very big conflict like the Middle East, it's still the same question. Mm. What does a common future look like? If you can be specific about that as a party to a conflict, then you have a very, very, very nice pathway in front of you to nonviolent conflict resolution. Mm. And that's really where Ikeda would start, I think. There's one quote from Ikeda that I really come back to all the time these days, in these dark times. And that's a quote from One by One, the essay collection from 2004, where Ikeda's essays on peace is gathered. And he says, "The real struggle of the 21st century will not be between civilizations, nor between religions. It will be between violence and nonviolence. It will be between barbarity and civilization in the truest sense of the word." I think that's really a quote that is necessary in the times we're living. The question of violence or non-violence, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, when you have a conflict in front of you and you have a peer pressure of taking sides, what party to this war do you want to align with? Mm. The big question isn't really there. It's, do you take the side of peace against war, or do you side with any warring parties? That's a very, very different take on it. And I believe that it's exactly that prism of nonviolence that is essential when we try to define what peace is. As we talked about previously, in the context of the least common denominator of peace work, it has something to do with nonviolence, how you promote nonviolence. And the same thing here. If you look for today's enemies' possibilities of living together in a shared future, then you can clearly see a way forward towards nonviolence.
Mm. Wow. That was really powerful, Alexander. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, you talked about conflict even with a friend or with your partner, for example, yeah. And it just made me think about, you mentioned that peace looks like being able to imagine a shared future with even our enemies. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, like, in your personal experiences, like, how does one go about doing that?
Yeah.
You know, because I think I sometimes can't even imagine resolving a particular conflict with my wife, for example. And she's someone who I love and respect, and that I share a home with. And so to think that I can imagine resolving conflict with someone that I genuinely dislike or even hate, how does one even start to engage in that process of imagining?
Yeah, I mean, if we start with the really big stuff, the really difficult things, when you have organized violence where people are actually willing to kill each other. Well, if you start at that level, the first thing is to acknowledge that everyone who is in a war have security needs. And if you can start by acknowledging your enemy's legitimate security needs, then we have established a very fertile ground for coming to a shared vision of what our future could look like. And I believe that if you take that path, of course, if you're mortal enemies, there's not all your security needs that will be seen as legitimate by the other side. Mm. But if you start with that perception that there is, you know, certain security needs that are legitimate, just because we're humans, just because this is a key part of the human experience that we can all relate to, then you have a path forward. And there's another thing which is very, very, very interesting with how to pose that question. What is our shared future together? And that is that you can actually use it in all the different phases of a violent conflict. I mean, if you come to the prevention of violent conflict, it is I found it in my life very, very, very useful to pose that question. I mean, when you are there, you're seeing that, okay, we are in a situation where conflict is escalating. It's about to turn violent. Okay. Start with that framework. What could a future, which we both want to be part of, which we both want to see happen, what could that future look like? That's very, very easy on the conflict prevention side of things. And of course, when you get into to an active, violent conflict and you're in the managing phase of this, you're trying to manage the conflict and you try to figure out a way to transform this conflict from a violent to a non-violent conflict, okay, then you still can use the same tool, the same question, posing the same question. It just sounds very different when you're in the active conflict management phase. So, but still helping the parties to the conflict, helping them come into a creative mode where it's actually possible to start thinking about a future that is not defined by the violence committed at the moment, but that is a future that you really want to see happen, that you want to be part of, and that is actually including your enemy, is still the pathway out, I would say. And lastly, when it comes to the time after violent conflict, when it comes to the reconciliation phase, then it's almost self-evident, isn't it? That, you know, in many ways we can say that reconciliation with your wife or with your friend or between Russia and Ukraine, same thing. That reconciliation, let's put it another way. If you don't have a vision of a common future, can you then ever reconcile? I don't think so. I think you need to have some sort of understanding and willingness to go towards that common future, to truly reconcile.
Yeah, that's so true. Or else it would be like putting a Band-Aid without really getting to the root cause of the issue. So I really love that, Alexander, because it's making me think about, you know, why is it that we continue to come to these moments of war and violence? And it's often, I think, not to simplify things, but that we stop a war or we end a particular conflict or violence without providing that shared vision, or without engaging in that process of imagining a shared future where we can all coexist. Yeah. So then we kind of go back to our original ways of being until another conflict or point of tension arises again. So,
and that's often why we talk about cycles of violence, isn't it? That, you know, the need to break that cycle of violence. And that's exactly what's happening in that reconciliation phase. That's sort of a proof of coming out of that track.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, that makes me think why Ikeda always says that dialogue is the surest path to peace.
It reminded me, we've read this a few times, but he sent many messages to the Ikeda Center throughout his lifetime. And in one of them, this was 2 years after 9/11, and he says in this message that in this time of severe trial, humanity must take the first step on the path of courageous dialogue, which will connect people heart to heart and pool their wisdom. Open dialogue is the only way peaceful coexistence will occur. It will transform prejudice to understanding, mistrust to empathy, and conflict to harmony. And I wanted to ask you about this because, you know, you talked about this, this hatred. From Ikeda's perspective, you know, that I just read about dialogue, how do you think, well, one, do you think dialogue is possible in this moment when this hate is so strong? And if it is, like, how does one even begin to imagine what that kind of dialogue could look like?
Well, again, let's return to Ikeda. You know, that phrase that you have there in the quote, courageous dialogue, courage. Mm-hmm. Courage is key. Now, if you look at Ikeda's practice, one thing that has struck me when I'm studying Ikeda's university addresses is that he exemplifies that courage, that courageous dialogue. Courageous dialogue, what I'm trying to come at is that it's not just something that just comes out of nothing. I mean, Ikeda has a method, and it's very evident when you look at his university addresses. What is it that he does to open the floor for transformative dialogue? Well, the first thing he does is that he tells the audience, I know who you are. I see you. Ubuntu. That's what he's doing. Look at the first time he's at Moscow University. Mm. The first paragraphs of his speech is not about him. It's about Russians, new Russians. And he's giving them the insights. He's letting them know that I know who you are. I know your favorite poets. I know your literature. I know the state of life in Russia. I know who you are. So he's building trust by just simply exemplifying that I see you. I know who you are. I take you seriously. And that's part of it. Now, to enter into the next stage, which is after he has established that, you know, I see you. I know who you are. He tells a little bit about who he is. Okay. So I'm coming from Japan. I come from a different place than you. I come from a different thought. But I'm here appreciating what I see. I'm different. Yeah, I'm different. We do things differently. We are different. But I respect you. In this cultural difference, in this intercultural dialogue, I respect you. Mm. And then that is sort of the second building block. That respect, that all cultures have always something to learn from each other, and I'm here to learn from you. When that is established, then you can start talking about courage, because then you have built the trust, you've been courageous in expressing the true sense and your true appreciation for the people you're with and gratitude for who they are. You're not there to change them. He's not there as a cultural imperialist. That's why Ikeda is so strong against, he talks so strongly against cultural imperialism all the time, because he comes from another approach where, you know, he's looking for not what divides us as people, he's looking for what unites us. And in that, he starts his dialogue with a foreign culture, with a different people, by telling them very clearly that I know who you are. So I know what I'm talking about. I'm just not passing by. I've studied you guys. I know who you are. And then secondly, I respect who you are. And I appreciate who you are. And I even want to learn from you. And that's when you get into the transformative stage, isn't it? When you say that, okay, we are now in a respectful dialogue, and I'm giving you a very clear signal that I'm willing not only to listen to you, on your premises, but I'm willing to change.
Yeah.
I'm willing to change as part of this conversation. That is the true transformative dialogue. And all these steps, as you see, demand tremendous amount of courage in the state we're in. Every single step demands enormous courage. And that's why that concept, courageous dialogue, is so crucial. It is so crucial, and we should never take it for granted. Don't think that this one is easy. I've studied dialogue methods from very many different peace philosophers. And you know, in peace theory, we have all these different theoreticians talking about how dialogue works and, you know, what is the conditions for dialogue to work in a, you know, nonviolent conflict resolution setting and so on. And I can tell you that Ikeda's approach to dialogue is not a simple one. Not compared to anyone.
Absolutely.
This type of dialogue that Ikeda is promoting, and that, you know, that he spent his life developing and utilizing. This type of dialogue is extremely demanding, because it demands a sincerity, an openness to change, and a willingness to change. What I think is one of the key factors that drive many of us intellectuals out on those romantic and, you know, theoretical, abstract approaches to dialogue has to do with exactly this courage part, that we simply want to make it easy for ourselves.
Yeah.
The problem here is that, you know, if you're going to achieve what Ikeda wants us to achieve through dialogue, a transformative dialogue, you've got to have all those components I mentioned.
Right.
And you can't really get this thing going without those ingredients. That's not the same cake. So, you know, it's demanding. And it takes, I've been focusing upon courage now, but it also takes a lot of compassion. And compassion isn't that easy. I mean, compassion, when you are, again, in the context we're discussing right now, maybe the deepest form of hatred we have in the world right now, you know, that we see in the Middle East, fostering a culture of compassion, you know, how do you create compassion in people or in families that are clearly as victimized as you can be? I mean, it's so obvious that we have, you know, that we shouldn't take these things too easy. But at the same time, it's so obvious that the only way out of it is dialogue. Absolutely the only one. So, you know, the Ikedian dialogue, this is the time to dig deep into it and really focus upon what we can learn from this approach. You know, Ikeda has so many different tools for us peace workers. Ikeda, through his life, he dealt with just about every of the big peace causes in the world's peace movement. I mean, there's almost no element that he doesn't touch upon. Everything from family violence to nuclear weapons and deterrence and everything. They are there. It's a very big toolkit out there, which is logically connected to what I call the Ikedian peace philosophy. And I'm saying that in times like ours, that toolkit is quite interesting. Let's have a look at it. Let's explore.
Yeah. I appreciate your response on so many levels, Alexandra. And I, you know, we talk about courageous dialogue at the Ikeda Center a lot, but the way you were able to unpack it further was deeply encouraging and made me think about when Ikeda said that dialogue can be likened to this spiritual exertion to remove, you know, anything that obstructs our common humanity. We talk about it a lot at the center about how difficult it is to truly practice Ikeda's way of dialogue.
Yeah.
So I really, really appreciated the way that you shared it with us today. And maybe this is a good segue into our next question. I have just two more questions for you. This one is related to the center. And, you know, we're so, so thrilled to have you join the center as our senior peace researcher.
Oh, I'm so happy to be part of the family.
Yes, we're already learning so much from you. So I wanted to ask you, one, what you're looking forward to in this new role. And from your perspective as a peace builder, what do you feel like is the role and mission of our center in this larger peace movement right now?
Oh, there's so much, so many things I'm looking forward to, you know, in our cooperation to come. I think that, you know, the time we're in now, it demands much more of us when it comes to knowledge of Ikeda's practical peace policies. As you know, he passed in November, and it's now time for those of us who really care about this peace philosophy to study it deeply. and to help new generations, new people who come across this peace philosophy understand not only the depth of it, but the utility of it, the utility, mm-hmm. how it's possible to use it. So I really feel that, you know, the work that you are doing at the center, I mean, of course, I mean, the center has been up and going for a long time, 3 decades plus. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff you've been up to. And there's a lot of good contributions made by the center over the years. But for the next 5 years, you're going to be more focused upon the peace element. I mean, of course, you have the learning and you have the dialogue, which it will continue, of course. But, you know, we're going to have some special emphasis on the peace issue, connecting to the peace academia, connecting to the peace movement, connecting the peace ideas of Ikeda to the ongoing discussions on war and peace more generally. And that's where I come in. That's where I hope to contribute at your center. And I'm really, really, really looking forward to it. It's a center that I followed for very many years, and I had the great pleasure of visiting you a few times. And I'm so impressed not only with you as persons and, I mean, how good you are as people, but also how this institution, how well suited it is for exactly what we were talking about, the transformative dialogue, the Ikedian style dialogue. So, you know, coming into a workspace where I will only be there part-time. I will continue my work here at the Soka University of America, where I'm a distinguished professor. So it will be a part-time work, but I'm sure that those days and weeks spent over at your center in Boston will create not only joy, but also a lot of hopefulness that I can bring back to Soka University of America too. So I also feel that me coming over to you guys is also a bridge building between our institutions, which are both founded by the same man, the man we're talking about today, Daisaku Ikeda. And, you know, strengthening our identity as a peace university at Soka University is really, really, really important these days, you know, to return to the founder and the founder's ideas. Almost all the work I do over here at Soka University is about that. And from a different, of course, the Ikeda Center in Boston is a different platform with a different mandate. It has a different role. But essentially, to me personally, the reconnecting to the founder's idea is quite similar. So I'm pretty sure that whatever we will create on the Boston side of things, there's a lot of good and there's a lot of spirit that will come back to SUA. So I have a very, very good feeling about just, you know, I already feel you've been so generous and so open and so nice accepting me already. So I already feel that I'm part of your family over there, but I'm also looking forward to, you know, try to be a bridge, you know, between the family we have over here at on the West Coast at Soka University of America and you guys over on the East Coast.
Right. Yeah, I resonate and appreciate a lot of what you shared, Alexander. You know, we have two SUA alums here, so I think they would appreciate this bridging as well. And you are part of our Ikeda Center family already. I really feel like the timing in which you joined our team, especially after Mr. Ikeda's passing, I think at a time when, you know, we could have spent a lot of time mourning the loss this incredible human being. But I think with your energy and passion, I think we've been able to channel that sorrow into sort of this determination to really advance his peace philosophy and to understand it more deeply ourselves. So the feeling is mutual.
And you energize me as well. So, you know, thank you so much for that.
Oh, thank you, Alexander. So, I can't believe, you know, it's already the hour. So I do have one final question for you.
Okay.
And, you know, so having worked in the peace movement for several decades now, I really wanted to ask, in a way, on behalf of many of the youth who, you know, come to the center, who are feeling very hopeless, like what gives you hope right now? What would you say to them? And what inspires you to wake up every single day and continue the work that you are doing?
Maybe this is, since this is the last question, maybe this is where we should round off by going back to where we started with this agency and responsibility. Because there's something here. You know, Ikeda talks about inner transformation. He talks about the need to take responsibility, self-mastery, not only for yourself, but take on responsibility for others. And I was talking about this in a different context earlier when I said that this is deeply connected to what meaning really is, that you need to take on responsibility, to actually experience meaning in your life. And here's the big thing with the youth coming in. Not all of them. I mean, there's not all of them who are thinking that, you know, world is going to hell and there's nothing I can do with it. There is a few other alternatives out there. So, you know, it's not that dark. But, you know, of course, you know, there are a lot of people out there. I mean, if you look at the mental health situation here in America, among young people, it's absolutely, I mean, there's no, I mean, the statistics are very clear. Young people are struggling. If you look at the age group 16 to 25, there's no doubt that we have deteriorating mental health ongoing. Yeah, well, that means that people are struggling. That means that people are finding difficult to find meaning in their life, finding difficult to wake up in the morning, like you say. And the best thing you can do to find that meaning that makes it natural for you to get up in the morning and get going on your project is, of course, to identify what you can do as a global citizen, as somebody who contributes to the ultimate goal, or what I would say is global civilization. How can you, if you have that clear path, I mean, it doesn't have to be pragmatic. I'm not a very pragmatic person. I'm a very idealist person. I really believe in ideas. And I don't think you need to be too pragmatic about things. And maybe that's why I find it kind of, it may be easier than most people to stay optimistic, even in war zones. You know, I've been working a lot in war zones. And of course, I get traumatized too, like everybody else. But I have a tendency to get up in the morning and think positively about the possibilities. And I think this has to do with really seeking what is ideal. To me, that's what idealism really means. Do you want to go for what is optimal or something else? Well, if you go for what is ideal, then in my thinking, you're an idealist. And I would advise people who feel the heavy burden of depression, anxiety, that have a general lack of self-respect, to try to think a bit about how ideas inform their life and what ideas that they intuitively find valuable. And, you know, the concepts of peace are something that just about everyone intuitively finds valuable. So exploring those ideas, rather than think pragmatically, what can I do to create, but rather exploring the idea and just experience the joy of positive thought. Because this is also something that we haven't talked about this time, which I think is so central to Ikeda's thinking, that it's always joy in doing good. It's always a joyful experience. And it's always with hope. He never leaves hope. And that's exactly what you have to work on every single day, you know? And I think that keeping to, you know, or at least that has been my path so forth. And that's also the path I'm suggesting and trying to you know, get across to my two children, age 8 and 11. And what I try to tell them is that there's two things you have to do. You have to be kind and you have to be good. So good doesn't mean, you know, make a lot of money or those kind of things, but you have to be good at something. You have to master something. You can choose what it is, but you have to have something that you can actually master. Mm. And you have to be kind. Those two, easy. If you do that, I'm happy. those two simple, you know, two simple goalposts. Because most of the choices you do in a day is not based on sound method and sound empirical findings. Not at all. You have to trust your instincts, and you have to orient yourself towards a ideal which is relevant to you. And I think most people will find peace, world peace, global civilization, those big goals, very, very interesting and nice ideals to have.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be one approach.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful approach, Alexander. And I love that you called yourself an idealist, because maybe I'll wrap up our conversation today with this quote by Ikeda that I love. And it's from one of my favorite essays by him that I'm sure you know, called Our Power for Peace. Mm-hmm. And in the essay, you know, he says, there are those who tell us that humanity is condemned to war and violence, that it is ingrained in our nature to hate and kill each other. Such people will tell you that they are simply being realistic. I sincerely hope that you will never submit to such realism, not about your own lives, not about the world. And then he goes on to say that every war has started in the human heart, and so has every great act that has changed the world for the better. So I love the way he talks about how we can challenge our own tendencies to be realistic, you know, in
fantastic,
that sense. So,
fantastic. Now, this is an excellent quote, and it's really about what we were talking about, isn't it?
It really sums up exactly
what we were talking about. And, you know, for our next conversation, one of the really cool things about Ikeda's thinking on this is when he turns this logic that you just expressed through this wonderful quote towards realism. Mm. Identifying idealism as the only true realist approach to life.
Wow.
But that's for a different conversation.
Oh, I'm already looking forward to it. I'm writing it down. So for our listeners, stay tuned for our next episode.
Oh, yeah. Oh, with Alexander.
But thank you for taking all this time today, Alexander. I really, really enjoyed our dialogue.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us in the Dialogue Studio today. If you are interested in learning more about the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue, you can visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Our next episode will be with one of our scholar friends, Roland Joseph. He is a member of Non-Killing Security and International Relations Research Committee at the Center for Global Non-Killing. Stay tuned. And until then, thank you and happy dialoguing.